This is the Diehards.
Sale winds. He fires. 20 and a miss. Strikely, it's over. The Red Sox have won the World Championship.
Tom Brady takes the snap, drops to the knee, and the Patriots have won their sixth Super Bowl title.
The Diehards start now on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Anthony Pepe and John Lyons.
Welcome to the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network. Bobby Krivitsky alongside John Lyons coming to you live from the Pepe compound in Boston, Massachusetts. We got John Bellmer producing the show back in Houston. John Lyons, a lot brewing in the world of sports. We're going to get to all of it over the course of these next 2 hours. But we start with Deshaun Watson, who went from the courtroom to the practice field where the Browns, are you surprised by the verdict now that it's going to be a six-game suspension, at least at the moment?
Yeah, and the word is surprised. I am, because with all the evidence, and if you read the judge's ruling, it seemed like she kind of agreed with a lot of the charges. She called them egregious, and yet six games. So, yeah, I was surprised, and it's funny because we're at the point of the year now where we're no longer in the quote-unquote kind of quiet period of summer in the sports world. We have the MLB trade deadline. We have NFL training camps going. We're only about a month away from NBA and NHL training camps. And yet this story has really been at the center of the sports world going on, obviously the allegations, but out a while, but going on a few weeks since this, you know, process was kind of wrapped up and they've been waiting for the judge's ruling. And now it seems like it's not going to go away. Because six games, I don't think it satisfies really anybody except maybe Deshaun Watson himself. So, yeah, I was surprised.
What's interesting is I don't even think it was done to get people prepared for what the verdict was going to be, or let alone take the temperature. It's a court ruling. But Deshaun Watson's legal team had been putting out there for a few days that they were confident the outcome was going to be in the 4 to 6 game range. You talk to most people and they would say that is way too light. It needs to be more. And so the question now, and we're going to get into this on the other side of the next commercial break that's coming up shortly, but the question now is, will Roger Goodell and the NFL take action to raise that suspension beyond six games? Because like you said, it is way too light and a bit of a surprising outcome here. Stick with us on the Diehards. We've got a lot more to dig into on this Deshaun Watson matter, plus the MLB trade deadline, and a whole lot more coming your way. And you're listening to the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network.
You're listening to the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Anthony Pepe and John Lyons.
You're listening to the Diehards here on the Sports Map Radio Network. Bobby Krivitsky alongside John Lyons coming to you live from the Pepe compound in Boston, Massachusetts, picking up where we left off regarding Deshaun Watson. John, we teased it before the break. Is it realistic? Should people, especially I would say Browns fans because it's their team, should they be thinking about the possibility of Watson having the suspension elevated beyond six games by the NFL?
Well, the weird part is the NFL put this system in place, and they agreed to with the NFLPA to avoid some of these appeals. And again, who's the appeal arbiter? Roger Goodell. So it's a really awkward place. And not to mention, this is the first ruling, major ruling, of that system. So then to add to it, overturn it, if you will, on an appeal, kind of takes the teeth out of this thing that they've agreed. So there's a lot of weird, different forces at play here. Because I think if you look at it at face value, if you're the NFL, you're like, all right, well, six games is not enough. I mean, they wanted a year plus, right? It was an indefinite, could not be suspended till after a year. Yet, do you want to undermine this thing that you have worked so hard to agree to, the first ruling of it? So, look, if I'm a Browns fan, I probably went into this expecting 12 to 17 games. So if it does get added on to, I wouldn't be shocked. But the NFL, it's not your typical appeal. They're in a weird place here.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's a tightrope that they're trying to navigate. How they go about it is going to be very interesting. They're a very PR conscious group. So that is going to play into it. The precedent, as you laid out, is going to be relevant to what they decide to do. And still, I think that there's going to be ultimately what prevails, a decision that we can't go crazy here and now suspend Deshaun Watson for the entire season. but it also doesn't seem right to just leave it be at six games. Yeah. And perhaps that another way to look at it from a precedent perspective is it lets people know that when we go down this road in the future, because we know we will, that don't just anticipate or assume that I won't touch it. You know, yeah. We fought hard for this system for a reason, and a part of that is to step in and say, you know what, we feel the punishment could stand to be a little steeper. And in this case, that certainly applies. So I still see Watson getting, maybe it's just one game because they're concerned about, you know, where's the line is. But I could see it going all the way up to eight games, which is about half the season.
Yeah, I could see eight. I could see as high as 12, doubling it. But I still think that would be a big precedent to set if you double what the arbiter ruled on. And what I found interesting is Deshaun Watson, his camp, and the NFLPA came out before this ruling and said, we will not appeal. The NFL didn't. So you almost wonder if the NFL had an inkling or a feeling that this was going to underwhelm them. And maybe Watson and his camp had a feeling it'd only be six games. So you wonder if there was kind of that feeling to begin with. Because, look, if I'm the NFL, and you mentioned the PR conscious part of it, how many of these over the last 10 years have they gotten wrong? Like, go back to Ray Rice. And you talk about Ray Rice, they got that wrong. They got Deflategate wrong. They get all these wrong. Look at how wrong they've gotten Dan Snyder, right? So you get all these things wrong. They want to try to finally get it right. They put this system in place. So I could see them adding anywhere from probably 2 to 4 games on and saying, look, we have this system. We wanted it to be more. We think it should be more, but we don't want to totally take the authority away from this thing we've worked together with the NFLPA to implement.
Yeah, exactly. So, again, it's such a difficult matter to navigate, no matter how you slice it. And so what happens here with Watson, now let's look at the fallout and spin it for a second from an on-field standpoint. Yep. Do you look at this and say, six games might be on the light side for the punishment, but for the Browns to lose him for that long, you look around and you look at the Bengals going to the Super Bowl and getting better, fortifying the offensive line, might knock them out of the division into a heavily contested wild card race. Do you look at this and say six games is enough to knock them out of the postseason picture?
I do. But on the flip side of that, if I'm the Browns, I'm probably a little happy that it wasn't more. Like, if I'm Kevin Stefanski, the Browns structured his contract the way they did for a reason. I think when they traded for him, they thought it would be at least half a season, potentially a full season. That's why they gave him a $240 million contract, but only $1 million this year. I mean, they did that for a reason. He only misses $350,000 in this suspension. So I think they had a feeling that, hey, we're getting this guy more for the next 8 years as opposed to, hey, the next 6 months. And look, do they want to be in the playoffs? Obviously. But, yeah, to your point, the Bengals just went to the Super Bowl. The Ravens are a great football team that had a ton of injuries last year. Pittsburgh, to me, is the worst team in that division, and they still have the defensive player of the year in T.J. Watt. So I look at it as the Browns are out of the playoffs this year, but going into next year, just from a football perspective, they will be one of the best teams in that division. I think they'll be a playoff team in 2023.
Yeah, like you said, they were content, clearly, when they made this deal and gave Watson the mega contract that comes with it, to say, if he gets suspended for the entire season, not that we want that, and it's a major blow, but so be it, because this is a long-term investment. So to get six games, there's probably a part of them that wants to pop some champagne corks right now. They'll happily take it. There's obviously the concern, they hold their breath, about what Goodell and the NFL might do here. But they're in a good position where this shouldn't altogether eliminate them from being in the race for a playoff spot, even if it doesn't happen. And then I'll be really curious to see how they build out the roster come the offseason, because there are some older defensive pieces. For instance, they took forever to bring back Jadeveon Clowney this offseason. And then what happens at wide receiver, too, is going to be another storyline. I mean, right now, for example, when you look in the slot, one of the people competing for a role there is tight end Hunter Henry as more of a move tight end to help fill that gap. So how they move on, you know, they lost Beckham last year, Jarvis Landry in the offseason. Right. So how they build this roster is going to be really interesting to see.
Yeah, and I think, like, let's not forget, Deshaun Watson didn't play at all last year either. So the last time he played in 2020, he had 4,800 yards, 33 touchdowns, only 7 picks. He was one of the best quarterbacks in the league. But we're talking, he was out all last year. He's going to be out at least 6 games this year. It wouldn't shock me if it takes him 4 or 5 weeks to really get his feet under him. Maybe have one good game early and then two or three games he struggles and then he finally gets back into it. But even if he's only suspended six games, if it takes him 4 weeks to get back on track, well, we're talking 11 games. So now at that point, you're really probably out of it. So I look at the Browns probably look at it as, hey, let's get him back part of this year, maybe to you said compete for a playoff spot, but then heading into next year, he's fully healthy, he's not rusty, we have a good enough roster around him, and then we can be a playoff team then.
And in those six games that he's out for, he has to be away from the facilities. So I know for sure he can't train with the Browns staff. The other question is, he'll already have, for example, he's at training camp today, he'll have the playbook and everything. He's allowed to study that on his own, though, right?
Yeah, and he could theoretically like have some of the receivers, I think, over to his house and throw. But, again, they're practicing getting ready for games. They don't have time to just, hey, let's go run routes with Deshaun. They have an actual job to do. So, yeah, but it's not going to be the same, right? It's still going to take time for him to work his way back, whether that is starting in week 7 or starting in week 9. I mean, we don't know. It could be starting week 7, week 9. And I just think it's going to take a while for him to be this 4,800-yard passer-type quarterback that we saw 2 years ago.
And if Deshaun Watson is messaging players on the team or members of the coaching staff with questions related to the playbook or whatever it might be that's team-related, I don't buy that the NFL is ultimately going to do a random phone check, for instance, and ultimately have a suspension related to that. So I think that they're going to be able to get away with quite a bit in trying to get him up to speed for when he comes off that suspension.
Yeah, and look, however long this suspension is, when you look at the Cleveland Browns, Jacoby Brissett is fine. But if they come out of the first six weeks of the season at 2-4, that's probably a good scenario for them. I mean, if they're 3-3 after six games without Deshaun Watson, they should be doing cartwheels. Because to go 500 without your starting quarterback, who, again, gross person, but I'm just saying football-wise, top 5-6 quarterback in the league, go 500 with him, you got to take that. So I look at them as 2-4 and 1-5. So to your point, that's not a playoff team.
No, I'm looking at their schedule right here. It starts on September 11th in Carolina against Baker Mayfield,
yep.
Which, I mean, you couldn't draw it up better than that for him to be playing his old team right from the jump, and it's in Carolina, which I like. Then they have the Jets at home for their home opener, followed by division rival Pittsburgh Steelers. Then they've got the Atlanta Falcons in the ATL, followed by the Chargers. So at that point,
and
that
the Patriots, I think, is that sixth game.
3, 4, 5. Patriots will be the sixth game. And at the moment, as the suspension stands at 6, the final one without Deshaun Watson. So I look at that schedule again. That's the Panthers, the Jets, the Steelers, the Falcons, the Chargers, and the Patriots. With Jacoby Brissett at the helm, I don't know, 3-3 seems possible.
Yeah, I would say 3-3 is a good ceiling because I think you don't beat New England, you don't beat
the Chargers,
and you probably don't beat Carolina week one flying around without Deshaun Watson. But then the problem is having your backup quarterback. Maybe Pittsburgh sneaks up on you and beats you, or maybe the Jets, who are getting better, sneak up. Like one of those games that normally you would not bat an eye
right.
at with Deshaun Watson, maybe you drop one of those and boom, there you go, you're 2-4.
Exactly. So we'll see how it all plays out if this does, in fact, derail them from the postseason picture. And, of course, there's a much bigger, more important topic at hand when discussing Deshaun Watson, who today was handed a six-game suspension. Stick with us here on the Diehards, because on the other side of this break, we are diving into the MLB trade deadline, where a significant player of note was dealt right before we came on the air. We'll talk about that, Soto, Ohtani, and a whole lot more. Coming up next on the Sports Map Radio Network.
You're listening to the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Anthony Pepe and John Lyons.
You're listening to the Diehards here on the Sports Map Radio Network. Bobby Krivitsky alongside John Lyons. And it is time to discuss an MLB trade deadline. It comes to an end tomorrow. But the hot stove is starting to get warmer, John. And so we have seen some major ones go down. We're going to discuss what's already happened along with a whole bunch of topics churning on the rumor mill on the other side of this break. But right now, let's get to the two hottest names on the market, and we'll start with Juan Soto. How do you see this ultimately playing out?
Well, the Juan Soto situation, to me, is one of the most fascinating MLB trade situations, if you will, in of the century, really, at least, because this is a guy that he's a back-to-back Silver Slugger. He was second in the MVP voting last year. He won the home run derby. He's been to two straight All-Star games. Oh, by the way, he's 23 years old. And he's got the rest of this year and two more years under team control. And, oh, by the way, he's already won a World Series. Like, every box you want to check for a guy, this guy has it checked. With the, and because of the team control thing, you could make a case that every single team in the majors could trade for him. Because if you're a team like the Dodgers or the Padres or the Mets or the Red Sox or the Yankees, well, you can trade for him because you're a big market team and you can afford him. But if you're a team, I don't know, like the Kansas City Royals, and you just want one of the best players in baseball and maybe take a run next year, you can afford that because you have 2 years of team control. And it, to me, that makes it so unique, this amount of control that they have, because, like I said, it takes it from a four-team big market bidding war to literally 25 teams could go for this guy. I mean, we could see the biggest haul in a trade in the history of the sport.
We've talked about it. Not every owner is in this to win championships.
Yep.
Juan Soto is great from a business standpoint.
Oh, yeah.
And you mentioned that if you're good enough, you get three pennant races with him on your team without having to invest big dollars into having him long-term on your payroll. He's currently making $17 million, so you get two arbitration years after that where even if it's a big jump, you're talking around $25 million at the most.
25, 20, even if it's 27, let's say it's $10 million more. For a $40 million level
player?
For at
that point, 1 year, maybe two. I mean, it's very easy for any of these owners across baseball to absorb the hit.
Like, look at a team like the Baltimore Orioles, who finally don't suck anymore. Well, if they get Juan Soto, as bad as the Red Sox have been, the Rays look like maybe they're a little bit of a down year next year. All of a sudden, the Orioles are in the playoffs, and you have Juan Soto. Look at any team in the AL Central. Right? What if the White Sox had Juan Soto? Or what if Cleveland had him? The bounce they would get. Because right now, that's one of the worst divisions in baseball. I mean, there's really no real playoff teams to me in that division. But you put him on a White Sox team with Abreu and Tim Anderson, all of a sudden you have a World Series contender.
Yeah.
And that's just one example. But to your because of this team control, anybody can go get him.
Exactly. And you talk about his age only being 23. There were 12 players from this year's Futures game that are older than Juan Soto. And Soto, an ascending player at that age, is already considered by most to be one of the top 3 to 5 players in the game. Most have him top three. So, I mean, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with Juan Soto. We've seen some shuffling between, hey, it looks like the Padres are in the lead. Now it looks like it might be the Cardinals.
Yep.
It seems at the moment, John, like the big three in the mix are the Dodgers and the two I just mentioned. But especially after losing out on Luis Castillo, who we're going to talk about later, I'm not ruling out the Yankees coming now, I guess, out of quote-unquote nowhere in order to land Juan Soto.
Even look at Seattle, who just went and got Luis Castillo. They have Julio Rodriguez. I mean, you add Juan Soto to that mix, you're a World Series contender. You mentioned the Cardinals are a great example to me because they're a team that they try to win every single year. They do a great job, but they are not the financial powerhouse that the Mets, the Red Sox, the Yankees, and the Dodgers are. Now, I don't want to call them a mid-market. They're like in the middle of a mid-market and a big market, but they pay Nolan Arenado a lot of money. Paul Goldschmidt makes a lot of money, so maybe they can't afford to give a third guy a massive deal. But they can afford 2 years of $25 million on arbitration, and boom, they're the best team, or one of the best teams in the NL. It's crazy. And by the way, Soto, we mentioned all these great things. 2020 and 2021, he led the NL in on-base percentage. I mean, there's nothing this guy doesn't do to any contender, any style of play. He's going to elevate any team in the majors.
Yeah, sometimes it gets thrown around like a cliche, but he legitimately is a five-tool player. Yeah. I don't think anyone would dispute that. And the Cardinals' reports have suggested that what they're offering is a package primarily built around players on their major league roster as opposed to prospects. So that's money going out the door that makes, even if it's a jump to that $27 million range in arbitration, it makes it more tolerable for Cardinals ownership, even as they spend on Arenado and Goldschmidt. I mean, any team can justify going after a player like this, especially with the contract set up. But if you're the Cardinals and you're spending this kind of capital to try and win now, go get Juan Soto.
Yeah, and I think not only can any team financially justify this, but any team can justify this baseball-wise, and not just for the obvious reasons of this is a top three player in the league. But you look at all the contenders, Well, Soto probably makes you the favorite. But even all these teams that are, I mentioned the Orioles, maybe a year away from contending, maybe even 2 years away from contending, well, you'll have Soto for those 2 years. So even if you're sitting there and you're the Texas Rangers and you're like, you know what, next year's our year. We made some splashes this year, but we really need another. Well, you'd have them next year. So to me, even these teams that are not there right now, they, baseball-wise, can still justify giving up the prospects, the major league talent, and the money to get him because he'll be there whenever it is they're ready to contend.
Not to mention, it's not the same as when you bring in an older veteran player like a J.D. Martinez to the Red Sox, and he's helping out the younger guys on the team. But the energy, not to mention the bar raising when you bring in a player of Juan Soto's caliber, that has a lasting impact on your younger players that you think will be there for the long term and a core part of your club.
Yep.
So the benefits to having Juan Soto, even if it's just for three pennant races, they're going to go well beyond that. Not to mention, if that's the plan, hey, we are not an operation that's going to give him the mega deal, well, then you trade him and you get a whole, you know, just boatload of prospects, for instance. So I see no reason why anyone, you mentioned the Orioles, it's a prime example, should not be in the mix and aggressively pursuing Juan Soto.
Yeah, because even, again, it fits literally every box there is.
Exactly. And then the other megastar that to some extent is on the block, but I just can't imagine, John, that the Angels ownership would actually sign off on trading Shohei Ohtani.
Yeah, and there's been reports that they've come out and said, okay, we're not going to deal. I think of the two, Soto is the much more likely to be dealt in season. I think these are both probably off-season deals, but especially Ohtani, because Ohtani's financial situation is so unique in that you could pay him like the top pitcher in the MLB and the top hitter. So we could be talking about Ohtani asking for $60 million a year, and before we laugh at that, well, if he pitches as well as Max Scherzer and he hits as well as Juan Soto, $60 million a year is not really that unreasonable. So I think because of that, and also Ohtani has more no-trade provisions in his contract, he might not want to go off the West Coast. His deal will be a little bit more complicated. I can see him getting dealt. I could see maybe Mike Trout getting dealt too from the Angels, but I could see him getting dealt. I just think that is a November-December type deal.
Yeah, the Soto thing seems like it's been stoked by competitors, not by his, or excuse me, Ohtani, not by Ohtani's camp, for instance, let alone the Angels that, hey, he wants out or they might be trading him at this deadline. It seems very much like people trying to grease the wheels in the interest of seeing him go elsewhere, although I don't know why you would. He's on a team that's not winning and perennially misses the playoffs. But to the Angels' credit, John, they consistently spend big money. Normally it doesn't work out, the Josh Hamilton deal, the Albert Pujols contract, but they normally aren't afraid to shell out what it takes to bring in a big headlining household name. And so in regards to Ohtani, who, again, you talk about it, it's a business. From that line alone, he is such an advantage to have on your team as one of the faces of the sport. We were saying off the air that he is literally doing what Babe Ruth did, but at a far more impressive level because it's modern times. And so to trade that when you don't have to, and he's not even commanding a massive deal at the moment, it would make no sense.
Yeah, and we've talked about this before. I think it's a crime that over the last 10 years, the Angels have been as futile as they have. I mean, they've had Mike Trout all this time. They've had Ohtani all this time. And yet, Ohtani's never played in the playoffs. I mean, to me, that is
Mike
an embarrassment.
Trout's barely been there.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think he got there for one series in 2014.
Yeah, he had a cup of coffee.
Yeah. So to me, it's embarrassing to the Angels. It's embarrassing to baseball that these two guys in an LA market, big market, are stuck at home every single October. They either got to figure that out in Anaheim or they got to move these guys to somewhere they're going to play in October.
Let me ask you this. We're starting to see for a while, really up until now, it's been common that teams are willing to let their star go to the market knowing that they're going to sign somewhere else, like Bryce Harper going to the Phillies. Do you think that it's about to change and that star trades all of a sudden become the norm?
I think it's in the national situation, I think they're going to definitely trade Soto. The Angels I could see, but I think the Harper situation and some of those, they were contending to a point. I mean, the Nationals won the World Series the year after Harper left. They were good. But I think any team that is in the borderline, I think we are going to see a little more of this going forward.
Stick with us here on the Diehards because we have a lot to discuss from moves that have already happened to some that seem like they're getting close. And you're listening to the Diehards here on the Sports Map Radio Network.
You're listening to the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Anthony Pepe and John Lyons.
You're listening to the Diehards here on the Sports Map Radio Network. Bobby Gravitsky alongside John Lyons. John, we're talking MLB trade deadline. We have already had major moves go down, including quite a few today. Let's start with one that happened, I believe it was Friday, where Luis Castillo ends up going to the Mariners. Maybe it was Saturday, sometime over the weekend is the point. Luis Castillo, the top pitcher on the market, ends up in Seattle with Julio Rodriguez and company.
As a Red Sox fan, this one broke my heart because I love Luis Castillo ever since 2019 when he burst onto the scene in his first All-Star appearance. And it's funny because he goes to Seattle, and Seattle was kind of floundering, and then they got hot before the All-Star break. Julio Rodriguez put on that huge show All-Star weekend, and then they came out of the break playing well, and it seems like in a division that still has the Astros, they're going for it. And Castillo, look, he's got a 2.86 ERA, 90 strikeouts in 85 innings, and this dude throws at 100 consistently. Like, this is a guy that in a playoff, like, he reminds me of a guy, like, he's a guy to me in a playoff game. He'll give them at some point like 7 innings of shutout ball in a playoff game. And I don't know if he'll win them a series single-handedly, but this is a guy that you can give the ball to. He is not going to be scared. We saw him, no hit or one hit the Yankees
in the Bronx.
Yeah. So he's not scared. He's going to get the ball at some point in a playoff game, throw you 7 shutout innings, and win you a game. I love this move for Seattle.
Yeah, it sets them up for the present and for the long term.
He is under control next year, by the way.
Exactly. And I think they made this deal with the intention of keeping him past his current contract. We'll see how that unfolds. But at the moment, they're in that number 2 slot in the wild card race. And you brought it up there. Castillo can pitch home or the road. Just give him the ball and get out the way. So if they have to go to, at the moment, it would be Toronto, so be it. You can feel totally confident and relaxed about who is on the mound for your club.
Yeah, and Castillo, we mentioned the Yankee Stadium. I believe that was the same week that he went into Fenway and two-hit the Red Sox. And that was at a time when the Red Sox were not the bad Red Sox they are now. So he's gone into tough environments and pitched really well. He's pitched well in All-Star games. So he's pitched well pretty much wherever he's been, home, road, AL, NL. And I think Seattle is one of those teams, again, that maybe Juan Soto contending team, one of those teams that is on the come up but has enough young pieces that I could see them being good for several years going forward.
Do the Mariners have the prospects, and they don't necessarily have to have the financial capital because we talked about Soto's contract, but do they have the prospects to get both players? Is that realistic for them?
You know what? That's the thing. I think because if you're the Nationals, you probably say, well, give us Julio Rodriguez.
Right.
And if you're the Mariners, you say, well, we appreciate that, but no thanks. Look, can Seattle probably swing it? Yeah, but with what they gave up for Castillo, would it maybe take a third team coming in? It would be a little creative. But even let's just take Soto out of the picture. You got Luis Castillo in your rotation, and you got Julio Rodriguez in your lineup. This is a good baseball team. And again, if they weren't in the same division as the Astros, I mean, if they were in the AL Central, they'd be leading that division. So this is a good baseball team that just got better.
And when you invest in your club, it gives them some extra juice, and a team that probably just got that today got arguably, and I would say, the second-best starting pitcher to move, and that is Frankie Montas, now going to be donning the pinstripes of the New York Yankees. He goes with relief pitcher Lou Trevino to New York in exchange for a package of prospects headlined by a pitcher, Ken Waldichuk, a starter who's highly touted. We don't need to get into the prospects. What matters is the Yankees, to this point record-wise, best team in baseball, even with the Dodgers nipping at their heels in that regard. But look, they've run into this wall countless times already this decade where you're not going to slug your way to a World Series title. So the rotation needed to get better to round out this team. You get Montas, mission complete.
Yeah, and Waldichuk, he's the best-rated pitching prospect the Yankees have. I say worth it because Nestor Cortes right now could win the Cy Young. He's got a 2.53 ERA, 9-3. He's been great all year. But then we look at Montas. Well, he was 6th in Cy Young voting last year. And you look at, he's 4-9 with a 3.18 ERA. It's not his fault that the A's lineup sucks. 109 Ks and 104 innings pitch. I mean, now this is their second starter behind Cortes. You line that up in a playoff series, that can go toe-to-toe with just about any rotation in baseball.
I think if you're a Yankees fan, you have to have some concern about Garrett Cole in big moments.
But I didn't even mention him. Like, think about it. Like, and sorry to cut you off, Bobby, but Garrett Cole now is like the third guy I'm thinking of in that rotation.
Right. And so it's not that he hasn't come through in the past, most notably Houston, in those spots, but in New York, it's been a bumpy ride, and so there's got to be a little bit of breath holding, especially going into a game, you know, where a lot is on the line, like a postseason one. So to have Montas behind him, whether it's Cole just spun a gem, and now we have Montas on the mound, so we can take a commanding lead in a series, or it's, you know what, he didn't show up, he kind of David Priced it, if you will, but now we have Frankie Montas to balance that out, yeah, and we can move forward with things being in an even position. That type of insurance has to be comforting.
And you look at, just to me, like World Series level pitching staffs rotations. Like the Yankees one, I'd still take the Mets front three starters if they're all healthy. I would take the top of the Dodgers rotation. I'd probably take the Padres overall rotation, but I think the Yankees top is better. But now it's like we're splitting hairs almost. Before, the Yankees still kind of had that gap because of the Cole uncertainty. Now, like if you argue to me, you take the Yankees over the Padres, I'd be okay, I can see that. And if you'd say, oh, they're as good as the Dodgers 1-3, I could probably see, you know, you can make the case now. Whereas 24 hours ago, you'd say there's those three teams, a little bit of a gap in the Yankees. Now they're on that level. You put that with a great bullpen in that elite lineup that they have. To me, the Yankees are probably one of, what, three, four true contenders to win a World Series right now?
Yeah, and when you look at their road to get there, it's not that the Blue Jays, the Rays, the Mariners with Castillo in the mix now, it's not that they can't upset one of these two, but it seems like a two-team race between the Yankees and the Astros. So it's going to be really interesting to see how Houston, yep, counters this. You know, obviously they're focused on building their club, but you do have to keep an eye on your competition. And so Houston, they today trade for Christian Vasquez. But to me, John, that's just a step. They have to move the needle more than that to keep up with New York.
Yeah, and I think if you're the Astros, like, all right, you were in the World Series a couple of years last year. You're in the ALCS every year. The Yankees are working to catch up to you. So if I'm Houston, maybe I look at it like with Verlander all out, I'm maybe still a little bit better than the Yankees. But to me, that is a very tight series right now. And let's not sleep on the Blue Jays. I know they've had some injuries. They fired the manager. But if they get into the playoffs with Vlad Guerrero Jr. and that lineup, they're going to give Houston or New York some problems. I still think Houston and New York are better. But if I'm the Astros, it's not us and everybody else like maybe it was the past 3 years in the AL. Now it's, okay, the Yankees are our equal, and we really have to battle it out with them.
Yeah, I think the Yankees were better going into the closing days of the deadline, and then they've done more impactful moves to this point. It's not over. Houston could swing something beyond the Vasquez acquisition. We'll see what happens there. Another big name on the National League side of things that got traded and stayed within that division would be Josh Hader. He ends up on the Padres.
Yeah, it's the first time in MLB history where the guys at 1-2 in saves are traded for each other, so kind of a fun fact. But Josh Hader leads the NL, 29 saves this year. And here's the thing. Right? If you look at the numbers, he has a 4.24 ERA, which is the highest, I think, of his whole career. But here's the thing. He's given up 16 total earned runs. Six of them were in one game against the Rockies. He had one terrible inning. So he had one terrible inning, and other than that, he's been dominant. I mean, we're talking about 10 earned runs the other 3 months of the season. So he's still one of the best relievers in baseball. He's got 59 strikeouts in 34 innings. If I'm the Padres, I have the Dodgers in my division. I know I have the Mets in the NL. But if I can find a way to get into the playoffs, Tatis Jr. comes back, and hopefully the Dodgers and the Mets play each other in an NLDS, and you only have to play one in the NLC. The Padres, to me, are that dark horse, and I don't even want to say fully, but they did miss the playoffs last year. They, to me, are a legit World Series contender. Maybe not quite the level of the Mets and Dodgers, but they're legit to me.
You talked about how good that rotation is. We all know about
all
Fernando,
five starters, ERA under four.
Right, and that's a great nugget right there. And we all know how good Fernando Tatis Jr. is. At the moment, the Padres, they occupy the second wild card spot in the NL, but they've got a number of teams nipping on their heels. So with Hader, you look at his struggles in July. Can they afford to give him some rest to make sure that his arm is good for the stretch run, or do they need to, so to speak, throw him into the fire?
It's funny because the Padres were, what, two games out of the division in late June, and now they're 12 games out. They've really had a tough July.
And the Dodgers caught fire.
And the Dodgers did catch fire. If I'm the Padres, maybe I give Hader a little breather, but not much. And I hope Tatis Jr. comes back soon, and I hope Machado is fully healthy and at MVP form, because as good as that rotation is, I don't know if I look at it like, oh, they have, you know, a Tony Gonsolin or a Max Scherzer-level ace. They have a lot of very good pitchers, but I think they need Hader as quickly as possible. So maybe a little bit of time off, but I wouldn't give much.
Among wild card teams alone in the National League, the Padres rank sixth in runs scored. So you talk about that rotation having to carry more of the load. You don't want to burn out the starters either. It's a very difficult tightrope to walk, but at the same time, I look at Hader's concern, how much hitters are starting to barrel his pitches and how many runs. You brought up that ERA being north of four. It does seem like this is someone who needs a break. They can't afford a long one, but maybe just a small respite to make sure that he's good to go. And you know, when you invest so much into bringing a player in, you obviously want to maximize the return there. So, again, it's a tricky situation, but you don't want to blow it by throwing, you know, having him do heavy innings right off the bat.
If they 10-day IL him and just say, okay, let's get right, fine. More than that, though, then I start to get concerned because, again, you still don't have Tatis Jr. They've been floundering. You got to win all these close games you can win until that offense gets rolling.
Exactly. You've got to find a way to, I guess for them, tread water since they're already in the playoffs.
Right.
To end today, but it's a close competition. We'll see what happens there. When it comes to the Red Sox, they trade Christian Vasquez today to the team they're playing at the moment, the Houston Astros. It seems like the start where the floodgates are opening. And I mean, it seems like a safe bet that J.D. Martinez is gone by the time the deadline arrives, and I would think that Nathan Eovaldi, too.
Yeah, and I think definitely Martinez. I wouldn't be surprised by Eovaldi. And the thing about the Red Sox, they're 3-7 in their last 10 games. I think they won 8 games the whole month of July. It's not just those numbers, though. It's how bad they've looked. Like, you talk about the 25-8 game to Toronto, and Jaron Duran just stares at a ball that he misses. Sawamura overthrowing third base, which, a game that actually the Red Sox ended up winning. But still, they give up the tying run. All the errors. Franchi Cordero dropping a pop-up in the infield against the Yankees, and then they end up losing the game by one run. It's like they're losing in ways that are not Major League Baseball losses. Stupid errors, really bad pitching, dumb base running mistakes. So it's not just the numbers. It's the eye test, and they're failing both. So to me, if I'm the Red Sox, I sell. And I look at the Red Sox right now very much like 2014. 2013, they overachieved, won a championship. 2014, all those guys came back down to earth. They ended up selling. That seems to me last year to this year, and it's happening again.
Yeah, and within this disastrous month of July, Chris Sale went out the door as quickly as he came through it.
Yeah, that's another one.
Especially when it looks like they're being way more sellers than buyers. I would be surprised if he pitches again this season. That doesn't seem realistic at the moment to me.
Yeah.
So they were counting so much on Chris Sale, and he looked good when he came back, but to not have that option and know in the moment you're probably not going to at best is just a couple weeks towards the very end of the season. It makes it that much easier to push towards being sellers and start to plan for the future.
Yeah, and I think we could end up with a situation where they're trying to get Tristan Casas MLB at-bats and other players, Brian Bello, MLB starts, and all these guys really just setting things up for next season.
Yeah, exactly. And let me ask you this, because my take on the Xander Bogaerts matter, and this is coming from not what would I do, not what would I want to do or see happen, but if the stance is that we haven't spoken contract in a while, our last offer, we intentionally lowballed him.
Yeah.
And now we're saying we're not going to trade Bogaerts. Now, I understand if he tells them, I have a no-trade clause and I'm not waiving it in a contract year to go to a new environment at this point, that's fine. But I think they should be negotiating with the deadline as an endpoint to discussions, simultaneously fielding offers and saying, if we can't get a deal done, let's present him with some potential suitors and see if he'll take it.
Yeah, like if Bogaerts said they told me they're not trading me. I would not be shocked if somebody gives a big offer if they go for it. I mean, still, I think ideally you re-sign him and Devers in the offseason, and I know he's not the elite player that Devers is, but he is that franchise cornerstone clubhouse guy that if you're going to be rebuilding or have a reset, that's a guy you want leading things. So that's why I would want him back, not just for that he's a good player, but those other elements as well, which I think are really important.
Yeah, not trading him for PR purposes just to not have that on your ledger doesn't make much sense to me. Not to mention, if you're lowballing him and not making contract offers, then any good faith from that PR, it goes right out the door. Stick with us here on the Diehards, because we have so much to get to in the second hour, from Bill Russell to NFL training camps and a look at the most burning questions. And you are listening to the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network.
This is the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Anthony Pepe and John Lyons.
You're listening to the Diehards here on the Sports Map Radio Network. Bobby Krivitsky alongside John Lyons coming to you live from the Pepe compound in Boston, Massachusetts. We got John Bellmer producing the show back in Houston. John Lyons, there are a lot of people that hit me up on Twitter trying to get to you and find your Twitter account. You know, there's a very key article at the beginning of the name that throws people off in the search. So why don't you tell everyone where they can reach you?
So it's at The Real John Lyons, and it's J-O-N, not J-O-H-N, because unfortunately there's millions of people named John Lyons. So I had to make it The Real John Lyons, Bobby.
J-O-N like John Lester.
Yes.
And look, as someone who, when I tweet out to promote the show and we're working together, you can't just start it John Lyons. It needs to be The Real John Lyons, people. And remember, that's J-O-N. You can reach me at Bobby Krivitsky. And you can find the Diehards at Sports Map Radio as well. Stick with us here on the Diehards, because hour number two starts next on Sports Map Radio Network.